We might like to be turning to Matthew chapter 16, which is where we will pick things up this evening. We spent quite a bit of time yesterday focused upon chapter 13, which comes at the midpoint in the Gospel. Remember how I've said that the Gospel is structured around these five major teaching blocks, and chapter 13, the chapter of parables of the kingdom, is the third and the central teaching block. And there we learnt about the division that is generated by the teaching of Jesus. That as Jesus speaks the word, many are hardened in unbelief, yet to others, to those who become disciples, the secrets of the kingdom are being revealed. And then we saw in chapters 14 through to 16 that process being played out in developing division. Until we come to that high point in chapter 16, verse 16, where Peter confesses his certainty that Jesus is the Christ. You are the Christ, the Son of the living God. And immediately Jesus tells him that this understanding has come by the grace of God. So verse 17, this was revealed to you by my Father in heaven. Now that certainty that Jesus is the Christ, that itself has not come easily, but the disciples will have an even greater struggle understanding that Christ must die for their sins. So from verse 21 onwards, as soon as Peter has confessed that Jesus is the Christ, Jesus begins to teach about the cross, and immediately Peter rejects this teaching. He rebukes Jesus and is in turn rebuked by Jesus for unwittingly becoming the voice of Satan, the mouthpiece of Satan, who wants to divert Jesus from the cross. It will also be hard for the disciples to understand that the cross must set the pattern for their own discipleship, verse 24. If anyone would come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. So these things are things the disciples will find hard to understand. And so in chapter 17, in the transfiguration that follows, the Father speaks from heaven concerning the Son, and says in verse 5, "This is my Son whom I love, with him I am well pleased, listen to him." That voice confirms that Peter, James and John, who are there on the mountain with Jesus, seeing him transfigured, are right about the identity of Jesus, "This is my Son," but they're also told they must listen to him, especially when he teaches about the cross and about the implications of the cross for their own lives. Meanwhile, down in the valley, the other disciples are failing to cast out a demon. And when Jesus returns to them, he criticizes them for their poverty of faith, verse 20. "O you of little faith." And for the disciples, it seems to be a case of two steps forward, one step back, doesn't it? Taking that great step forward taking two great steps forward in seeing that Jesus is the Christ, and then taking a step back as they struggle with the teaching about the cross. They are a far from perfect group of people, which of course is why Jesus must die for their sins. Nonetheless, they are the beginning of the new community that Jesus is building. So remember how we saw Jesus saying to Peter, "You are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, my assembly, my gathering." Old Israel is going to reject Jesus, climaxing at the cross, but Jesus is building his new community, his church, a people gathered by him, called by him, a people who recognize that he is the Christ, the Son of the living God. And in chapter 18, which is the fourth major teaching block of the gospel, we come to teaching about the life of the new community, and especially the relationship between the disciples. But the lead into chapter 18, this teaching for the church, is the rather curious incident of the temple tax, the fish and the 4-drachma coin at the end of chapter 17. So let's just read that from verse 24. "After Jesus and his disciples arrived in Capernaum, the collectors of the 2-drachma tax came to Peter and asked, 'Doesn't your teacher pay the temple tax?' 'Yes, he does,' he replied. When Peter came into the house, Jesus was first to speak. 'What do you think, Simon?' he asked. From whom do the kings of the earth collect duty and taxes? From their own sons or from others? From others, Peter answered. Then the sons are exempt, Jesus said to him. But, so that we may not offend them, go to the lake and throw out your line. Take the first fish you catch, open its mouth, and you will find a 4-drachma coin. Take it and give it to them for my tax and yours. This ending to chapter 17 is actually showing that the disciples of Jesus, and we can count ourselves amongst them if we have faith in him, that we are immensely privileged. The issue is the payment of this temple tax, an annual tax, a very small amount of money really. But Jesus takes the opportunity to make the point that God does not tax his own son, just as earthly kings do not tax their children, their own family. So at one level, Jesus does not need to pay the tax. But he doesn't just say the son is exempt, he says sons are exempt. He seems to include Peter in this exemption. The disciples share his royal status. They too are exempt from the tax because God does not tax his own children. They have this immensely privileged status that they share with Jesus, the status of sons of God. Nevertheless, Jesus says, pay the tax. This temple tax represents the old order. It's collected by the temple authorities of old Israel. But the old order is not immediately going to be swept away. It will persist for a while, and so for a while the disciples must continue to live with the old. But rather than parading their kingdom privileges as sons of God, saying we're exempt from the tax, Jesus requires that his disciples submit to the demands of the old order in order not to cause unnecessary offence. So I'm sorry, next time you get your tax return, you can't write across it, Son of God, exempt from all taxes. But why the fish? Well, surely the point lies in the fact that this miraculous way of paying the tax was something that only Jesus could do. So Jesus says to Peter, pay the tax, and then he provides the resources for Peter to do so. In other words, Jesus provides for the demands or the meeting of the demands that he places upon his disciples. There's no command without provision. Jesus does not direct us to do anything which he doesn't give us what is needed to do it. But not only is that true, it's also true that Jesus doesn't call us to do anything which he himself has not done. So he pays the tax and sets an example for us to follow. He is God's son. He is the calmer of storms. He's the multiplier of food. He's the mighty one, the one who can raise the dead. And he remains humble enough to pay a paltry temple tax in order not to cause offence. And this, in the context of teaching about the cross, the mighty one will allow himself to be delivered into the hands of men and killed. Such is his readiness to humble himself for our sakes. So this strange little section at the end of chapter 17, I think he's saying to us, we need to know who we are, sons of God. But we are not to parade our privileges and claim exemption from the demands of this world. No, we are to behave with humility in the world, submitting to the demands of this world in every way which is consistent with obedience to Jesus. But humility is not only required in our dealings with the world. Humility must also be the mark of life within the kingdom community, within the church, which leads to the teaching of chapter 18, where the keynote is humility. As we don't have time to look at chapter 18 in detail, but the first few verses teach that entry into and greatness in the kingdom community both require us to humble ourselves. Jesus says that if we don't become like little children, we'll never enter the kingdom of heaven. That taking that position of little children It is taking the position of one without status or claim. It's not to do with innocence. It's about having no status, no claim upon the kingdom, having to humble ourselves to enter it. And that same humbling must continually shape our attitude towards ourselves and one another within the kingdom community. That's the point that the rest of the chapter expands. And I've given you a framework there in the 6 points for the rest of the chapter that you can work through in your own time. But note that the theme of this chapter is not just humility. The theme is also the problem of sin. That much of the chapter is taken up with how to deal with sin within the church. So the church is far from being a sinless community. It is a community of sinners. Forgiven sinners, yes. Saved sinners, yes, but still sinners. And it's a healthy consciousness of our own sin and a healthy consciousness of the cost of our forgiveness paid by Christ that will keep us humble. And being humbled is key to preventing sin from tearing apart the community from within. Sin will always be present in the church. But if we don't have humility, we won't be able to handle it. And sin will tear the church apart. So that's the in a nutshell, the theme of chapter 18. Shame we don't have time to go into that this evening in any more detail. But following on chapter 18, the narrative continues. And the developing division now heats up as Jesus, at the start of chapter 19, leaves Galilee and enters the region of Judea, moving towards Jerusalem, the seat of power for the leadership of old Israel. And in chapters 19 to 23, the movement is towards climaxing confrontation that will lead to the cross. But before we get there, there is more material on discipleship and fulfillment. Remember that we said these are the major themes of the gospel: fulfillment, discipleship, and confrontation. And we find all three themes in this section. And in chapters 19 and 20, I think it's the theme of discipleship which dominates. It leads on from chapter 18. So first couple of verses of chapter 19, Jesus moves from Galilee to Judea, and the healings and the popularity continue. And then we find that chapter 19 and chapter 20 are structured around three dialogues about money, sex, and power. And when you think about it, that seems to encompass most of the things that most people are interested in. Once in a home group setting, I was teaching the parallel section in Mark's Gospel, and I decided I would take along some magazines that were aimed at women and some magazines that were aimed at men, the reasonably decent ones. And I gave the men's magazines to the women and the women's magazines to the men, and I said, just tear them apart, and I want you to put everything that's about sex and relationships into one pile, everything that's about money and stuff that you can buy with money into another pile, and everything that is about status and power in another pile. And then we'll see what's left over. Well, there was hardly anything left over. Nearly everything in those magazines went into one of those three categories. And the Bible is bang up to date in addressing the issues that concern people: money, sex, and power. And this comes through, first of all, in the dialogue with the Pharisees about marriage and divorce, then the dialogue with the rich young man about wealth and possessions, and then the dialogue with Mrs. Zebedee and her sons about status and power. And in the sort of structure that I've given you on the handout, those three dialogues I've called the A sections: A1, A2, and A3. And each dialogue, after each dialogue, we see the response of the disciples. And we'll see in a moment that in each case, it's a worldly response which Jesus has to correct. And those I've called the B sections. And then in each case, we seem to get a somewhat unconnected tailpiece, which I've called the C section. And in the middle of it all, we find a parable which stands apart, which I've called the D section. And I think that the key to these two chapters is seeing how the A and B sections connect to the C and D sections. I think we'll find this is a great example of the benefits of taking a longer unit of the gospel and working out the structure and trying to work out why has Matthew put what he's put here? Why has he put these things together? I think our problem with reading the gospels very often is that we read them atomistically. We just take the individual units. We just take the stories that we know. We study them and we don't see the connections round and about within the gospel. And I hope we'll see it's actually much more enriching and powerful when we do. So let's just work through this from top to bottom and see if we can make sense of it over the next 20 minutes or so. So first of all, the dialogue with the Pharisees. They come with their question about divorce. And you might remember that the teaching of Jesus in response to their question is to say that marriage was ordained by the Creator at the beginning and that what God has joined together, let man not separate. In other words, marriage between a man and a woman is for life. Once a man and woman are joined together in marriage, they're not to be divided except by death. But the fascinating thing is the response of the disciples, who we find actually quite cynical, we might say worldly, about marriage. What do they say? Well, they say, if this is the situation, Jesus, if this is how you're going to see marriage, well, surely it's better not to marry. You see what they're saying? That the teaching of Jesus about marriage, they say, makes marriage unattractive. As though the appeal of marriage is contingent upon liberal divorce laws and remarriage rights. You'll only want to marry if there's an easy get out and you can choose another wife to have instead. Well, that's how the world thinks, isn't it? And the reality is that the disciples are as far from God on this issue as the Pharisees. And so Jesus teaches them further, and he teaches them about singleness. So he says, let's just read this, verse 11. Not everyone can accept this word, but only those to whom it's been given. For some are eunuchs because they were born that way, others were made that way by men, and others have renounced marriage because of the kingdom of heaven. The one who can accept this should accept it. Jesus there seems to be saying that some have singleness forced upon them, but those who actually choose to renounce marriage should do so for the sake of the kingdom, not because they find the commitment of marriage unappealing. But not everyone can accept this word, only those to whom it has been given. In other words, the people of this world cannot accept the sexual ethics of Jesus. It's an example of another word the world cannot accept. Can't accept Jesus' teaching on this issue. And the disciples themselves are struggling. And then in the little C section that follows, children are brought to Jesus. And Jesus teaches his disciples that the kingdom belongs to such as these. And little children, in the light of chapter 18, represent those without status or claim. So to see yourself in that way requires self-humbling. How does that connect? Well, we'll see in a few minutes' time, I think. Then we come to the second dialogue from verse 16 onwards, which is the dialogue with the rich young man, and it's a dialogue about wealth and possessions. So you remember that this young man wants to know how to get eternal life. First, Jesus asks him about the commandments, and the young man says that he's kept the commandments, and says in verse 20, what do I still lack? And Jesus answered, if you want to be perfect, go sell your possessions and give to the poor, and you will have treasure in heaven, then come follow me. When the young man heard this, he went away sad because he had great wealth. So the reality is that this young man values his riches more than the kingdom. if he's forced to choose between earthly treasure and heavenly treasure, well, then he's going to go with the earthly treasure. He values his riches more than the kingdom. His attitude to his wealth is a barrier to his entry into the kingdom. And Jesus states, doesn't he, how hard it is for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. But then we come to the response of the disciples in the B section. And once again we find that the disciples are confused, that is, worldly, about riches and entry into the kingdom. Because they say, who then can be saved? That's their response to Jesus saying how hard it is for the rich to enter the kingdom. They say, well, who then can be saved? Now, why do they say that? Well, I think it's because they see this young man as representing the best that this world has to offer. Here is an upright young man who has kept the commands of God. I don't think he's being insincere when he says, I've kept those commandments. Okay, a penetrating analysis might reveal the points at which he's fallen short, but basically he's lived an upright life. He's an honourable, respectable young man who is wealthy. And surely, to the Jewish way of thinking, his wealth is a sign of God's blessing. So here is an upright, blessed young man that the disciples would see as being first, one of those people in the first place when it comes to entry into the kingdom. If they were to line everybody up in order of priority as to who they thought was most likely to enter the kingdom and who was least likely, they'd get this man at the front of the queue. In other words, they esteem this man's riches as much as he does. They're measuring him by his wealth. But they're saying, if someone like him fails to enter the kingdom, then who can be saved? And Jesus has to teach them what is impossible with man is possible with God. Yes, the rich can enter the kingdom, but not because of their wealth, but because of a gracious work of God that enables them to humble themselves and enter like little children. Then we come to the parable in chapter 20, which is the parable about people who are hired to do a day's to work in a vineyard. And they're hired at different points in the day, but they all get paid the same at the end of the day. And that seems grossly unfair, doesn't it? Shouldn't their reward be according to the work that they have done, their hours of labour? But the point of the parable is that the rewards that God gives are a matter of grace. The owner of the vineyard can choose to give what he wants. It's about grace. And Jesus ends the parable by saying in verse 16, so the last will be first, and the first will be last. And as R.T. France, I think, helpfully comments in his Tyndale commentary, that statement, the first shall be last, and the last shall be first, is a way of setting God's grace against all human notions of what constitutes firstness. See how it connects with the rich young man. If you're going to classify people as to who you think will come first, who merits entry into the kingdom, then you put him at the front of the queue. But then Jesus turns it all upside down by saying, well, the first shall be last and the last shall be first. In other words, entry into the kingdom isn't going to be according to merit. It's going to be according to grace. The rewards that God gives are a matter of grace. That parable has delayed the C section, the short section that comes at verse 17, where Jesus is going up to Jerusalem and he teaches his disciples that he must suffer and die on the cross. And that leads us to the next dialogue, the third of the dialogues. This time it's with Mrs. Zebedee and her sons, James and John, and this is about status and power. So, let's just read the beginning of this one, verse 20. Then the mother of Zebedee's sons came to Jesus with her sons and, kneeling down, asked a favour of him. What is it you want? He asked. She said, grant that one of these two sons of mine may sit at your right and the other at your left in your kingdom. You don't know what you're asking, Jesus said to them. Can you drink the cup I am going to drink. We can, they answered, of course, with not a clue what he was talking about. So Mrs. Zebedee wants her two sons, James and John, to have first place alongside Jesus. She's got this glorious picture of the kingdom in her mind where Jesus is sat on his throne and her sons are sat on his left and his right at first place alongside Jesus in the kingdom. Well, can you drink the cup I'm going to drink? The cup of his suffering, he means. They think the kingdom is all about privilege and power and they want a slice. Well, Jesus says, can you also share in my suffering? Their views of the kingdom are all quite wrong. But what about the rest of the disciples? Well, the B section here shows us their response, and they are indignant when they hear about this conversation in verse 24. Indignant. They resent this bid for first place, not because they think it is inconsistent with kingdom humility, but because they want first place. What has cheesed them off is that Mrs. Zebedee got in there first. That's why they're indignant. They are just as ambitious and just as worldly as Mrs. Zebedee and James and John and as the rulers and the high officials amongst the Gentiles. And so Jesus teaches them, whoever wants to be first must become your slave, just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and give his life as a ransom for many. So the example of Jesus, the Son of Man who's come not to be served but to serve, who will serve us above all by giving his life as a ransom for sin on the cross, that example of Jesus points to a completely different scale of values in the kingdom, where firstness is defined by service. If you really want to be first in the kingdom, then you need to become the slave of all. And then the final little bit of this whole unit is this final C section, where Jesus and his disciples are leaving Jericho and two blind men want to see. These two blind men are calling out to Jesus for mercy. Lord, Son of David, have mercy on us. The crowd rebuked them. Verse 31, tell them to be quiet, but they keep shouting all the louder, Lord, Son of David, have mercy on us. And Jesus stops and he asks them, what do you want me to do for you? Lord, they answered, we want to see. So Jesus has compassion on them, he touches their eyes, and immediately they receive their sight and followed him. And I think as we, this stage in the gospel, healing miracles like that are really quite rare. So there's some deep significance in Matthew putting that healing miracle at the end of these two chapters, a miracle of two men being given sight. And I think the question that we're meant to be asking is, well, what is it that the disciples need to see? Let's just draw the threads together. So we've seen the teaching of Jesus on three topics, money, sex, and power. And in each case, the response of the disciples to the teaching of Jesus in the dialogue has exposed them as being worldly in their attitudes. Actually, no different from the people of this world. They think that his teaching on marriage makes marriage unattractive. They're baffled by his handling of the rich young man, and they all want to share in the power play, bidding for first place in the kingdom. So we've seen their worldly attitudes. We've also seen that they don't understand the teaching about entry into and life in the kingdom, all against the backdrop of their failure to understand the cross. Then alongside all of this, in the C and D sections, we have Jesus teaching about humility with the little children, about grace with the parable, and teaching about the cross. Humility, grace, and the cross. So what's the point? The point is that the disciples are blind. The point is that spiritually they are blind. They do not see that their attitudes are all wrong. They do not see that they are sinners, even in the way they think. And so they do not see why Jesus needs to die for them. They do not understand the cross. They don't understand their own need of grace. They don't understand that if entry into the kingdom is based on merit, then they are lost. They are utterly reliant upon the grace of God, and they are utterly reliant upon Jesus dying for their sins. And if they understood that, then it would humble them. We're only humbled when we come to see that we really are sinners, in need of grace, in need of Jesus to die for us. And only when we are humbled by getting hold of grace and the cross, only then are we able to accept the teaching of Jesus and find our attitudes changing. In other words, the disciples need an eye-opening miracle just as desperately as those two men at the end of chapter 20. It's not enough for them to see that Jesus is the Christ while they remain blind to why he has come. There are plenty of people stuck in that position, aren't there? They do see that Jesus is special. They may even be prepared to say that he's the Son of God, but they don't understand the cross. They don't understand why he has come. They still remain blind to that. And that's where the disciples are at this point. And so they should be crying out to Jesus for mercy, saying, "We are blind, Lord, have mercy on us, we want to see." We need, all of us need, that eye-opening miracle. And our worldly attitudes to all things, including money, sex and status, can only be changed when we actually see the cross and truly get hold of the principle of grace. Because only that humbles us and opens us up to change in our attitudes for the renewing of our minds, so that our thinking about all these areas of life becomes conformed not to the ways of this world, but to the teaching of Jesus. Now, if we don't work at the connections here, if we don't take those two chapters and wrestle with why are these points put together in this way, these little units, why are they assembled in this way, I think if we don't make those sort of connections, then when we teach a section like this, we will end up teaching mere morality and bring about no change. It's simply no use preaching to ourselves or preaching to others for a change in attitude, be it in the area of possessions or relationships or status and power, without preaching the cross in such a way that we are humbled by it and the grace of God is magnified. For instance, you won't change your attitude to the issue of status and position in the church by thinking much about status and position. Now, you change your attitude to status and position in the church by meditating hard and long on the cross, seeing afresh the humility of Christ as the Son of God dies on the cross for our sins, marvelling at the grace of God shown to a sinner like you by a Messiah who came to suffer and die for you. It's only as we see that, as we know more of the cross, grasp more of our need of grace, that we are humbled and our attitude in all these areas can be challenged and changed. So as we read the word and as we look at the cross, we need to pray for that eye-opening miracle. Our prayer as we read the scriptures is, or should be, Lord, we want to see. In my sinfulness I'm blind. Help me to see. Help me to see those things that I need to see, so that I begin to understand them and begin to be changed by them. Well, let me pause there and see if you've got any questions.